This PrivCap podcast is sponsored by Alter Domus, a leading provider of integrated solutions for the alternative investment industry.
Hello and welcome to a PrivCap podcast. I'm David Snow, a partner at PrivCap Media. And today we're joined by Chris Flowers, CEO and chairman of J.C. Flowers & Company, a major private equity firm that invests in financial services companies across the world. Chris, welcome to PrivCap today. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much, David, and thank you to PrivCap for having me.
Obviously, your firm, J.C. Flowers, invests in financial services. That's a very large world. What subsectors are you most interested in right now, and which ones, by contrast, are you avoiding?
Well, we had a big day today, actually, David. We announced earlier today the sale of one of our portfolio companies, Interactive Investor in the UK, to Aberdeen, a UK-listed company. Very successful transaction. Interactive is the second largest wealth management platform in the UK. So one answer to that question is that we have found the asset management and wealth arena a very attractive one.
Why have you found wealth management to be attractive?
Well, you've got a real tailwind with just a lot of wealth creation around the world, everywhere, pretty much. And it's quite a fragmented industry. And so the opportunity to consolidate smaller companies into larger ones with economies of scale, you know, with a growing market, you know, has been very attractive. One distinction there is between wealth management and asset management. So asset management is like picking stocks and that kind of thing, where there's been a lot of pressure on fees and so on. Whereas wealth management is interacting with the individual customer and having a relationship with that customer. Banks are, a segment in which we've been very, very involved. We own several banks right now. And this is an area which is, we've done fine, but it's been tougher because of low interest rates. We're basically lenders, not borrowers. So higher interest rates would be good for us and lower interest rates are more of a headwind.
I know you don't want to give your view on what might happen with inflation. But if inflation does become more real and long-term, how would that affect your bank businesses?
Well, it's not so much that I don't want to give my view about inflation as that I have no idea what's going to happen with inflation. If there is inflation, then interest rates are going to go up. And if interest rates go up, it's going to help our industry. It's going to help banks. It's going to help insurance companies up to a point. You know, beyond a certain point, you know, inflation is sort of like bad for everybody, but a little bit higher interest rates would substantially add the profitability of banks and insurance companies.
Do you see any threats to the traditional banking business model, the lending business model dominated by banks on the horizon?
Well, there's many people talking about, thinking about, and indeed acting on perhaps the idea that, you know, that banks are dinosaurs and that they're going to get the Amazon treatment, you know, that the retail industry got. By the way, that phrase that banks are dinosaurs came from Bill Gates in the 1990s, and it's now 2021. And, you know, there's a lot of banks still around. So banks do a lot of different things, and some of them are being eroded by or threatened by fintech companies, and some of them are not. So to be an official bank, what that really means is that you have insured deposits in America, insured by the FDIC. And that is both a privilege, you know, but it comes with a bunch of restrictions. You know, the privilege is it's very cheap funding, no best leverage you're going to get anywhere, no covenants, no worries about credit, or none of that stuff. So it's a very, very good capital structure and basically much cheaper than anything else. On the other hand, you have a lot of regulatory constraints about what you can do with that money. You know, on the lending side, and what do banks do? They take deposits, they lend money, and then certain parts of that I don't see eroded by fintech anytime soon.
Are there any tech-enabled or internet-enabled or blockchain-enabled technologies out there that you do feel like are going to have a very big impact and a disruptive impact on more traditional financial services companies?
Let's talk about fintech for a second, and let's talk about payments and maybe then talk about lending. So let's take payments. So fintech has had a big effect on payments, and basically the transaction costs and payments and many parts of payments have been fairly high. And so fintech companies have offered a better deal for some parts of the payments world because they make it cheaper and easier and that kind of thing. Here's another important point. If you look at sort of retail payments, much of which is dominated by people like Visa and MasterCard, what's going on there is that the Visa and MasterCard and so on have got tremendous networks, and it is very difficult to compete with those networks. But if we have a digital dollar that was actually effective, where people could use their cell phones and their digital dollars to go around the, now you've got a network through your cell phone. If that actually would work and transaction costs got low enough, that would have a profound effect on retail payments.
Do you often encounter entrepreneurs behind fintech companies who perhaps don't have the requisite level of understanding of the regulatory complexities that they may face as they start to get bigger?
The Silicon Valley mindset, which obviously has produced some pretty spectacular results in a lot of industries, hits obstacles when in heavily regulated industries that they're not used to. Maybe that's the way to put it. They're not used to and don't anticipate. You take the auto insurance business. Let's take that example. Sort of insure tech for autos. Sounds like a good idea. In the United States, you have State Farm, Berkshire, and Progressive, huge dominant companies in that business, and a lot of entrepreneurial fintech type stuff going on. But I think what isn't fully appreciated is that, yes, underwriting is important, but so is claims adjustment, and so is marketing, and so is customer acquisition. So, for example, Berkshire and Progressive have tow trucks running around all the time all over Los Angeles or New York or whatever. If you have a car wreck, they get there in 10 minutes, makes a big difference on the claim adjustment. And, to try to compete with that with some fintech startup is really hard. I mean, it's really hard. So I think people often do underestimate, what's involved.
The term disintermediation gets thrown around a lot, particularly in the financial services world. To what extent is that real? And are there any subsectors within finance that you think this is going to have more of a profound effect than perhaps it might have elsewhere?
Well, the disintermediation is real. And to give you one example, if you look at the mortgage, residential mortgage business in the United States, it's chopped into about 25 pieces from, the customer wanting to buy the house to the investor that owns the bonds. So lots of different people involved along the way. And America is unique with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's, you don't see that other country. But anyway, that whole system is disintermediated by lots of people. And the result is it's very, very efficient. It's very, very efficient. So, if all you do is like title searches in Orange County, and you do a great job and bring the cost of that down, it just brings the whole cost down. And the way the investments are delivered to, directly to bond buyers, it's all very efficient. And so reducing the cost for home buyers. So, maybe you could say, in fact, I think you could say that that has disintermediated a role that savings banks had 100 years ago. The Bowery Savings Bank in New York or whatever was like the biggest savings bank in the world and a long time ago. I think parts of the payments arena will continue to get disintermediated. I think in the securities business, so for example, here's an example of disintermediation. In the old days, you had to have Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or both of them do your IPO. Now today, maybe the right company that can kind of list directly as another example. Anyway, I think it's a natural process of increasing efficiency and as much of an opportunity as it is a problem.
There are a lot of people whose careers are as intermediaries, investment bankers, you mentioned brokers of all types. Are there any particular jobs that you see going away?
Bank branches, I don't think they're going away completely, but, have been going down for years, so those kind of jobs, the number of branches, the amount of employment, those kind of branches going, stuff involving physical cash, has been going down for a long time. So those kind of jobs, I don't see dramatic elimination of high paying, high value added jobs in financial services. No.
Chris, let's talk about a very notable deal that you and your firm, JC Flowers and Ripplewood did in 2000 in Japan, an investment in Shinsei Bank. I know that was a big, complex deal, but for us, in a nutshell, can you tell us what made that investment successful?
Well, you had there a situation which we've seen before and since in many markets, which is banks getting in trouble, you know, in the business cycle, et cetera, you know, often results in banks getting in trouble. And that happened, you know, in the 80s and early 90s in the United States. That happened in Japan when we made this investment. That's happened since then in the US and elsewhere. When that happens and when governments take over banks and then they privatize them, those are often great opportunities. In this case in Japan, that's what you had. You had a bank that got in trouble. You had the government take it over. You had the government sell it. You know, a recipe for a great opportunity. I think one thing also that made that a great deal is, you know, people were kind of used to that idea maybe in America or maybe in Europe, but the idea of doing that in Japan, you know, was not an idea on many people's radar screens. We knew this could be a good deal. And what it really boiled down to was who would compete for this deal. And on the one hand, strategic buyers didn't want to deal with a mess. You often see that. So when the whole market, America, Japan, whatever, whoever turn it is at the moment is a mess, the banks all have problems, you know, then you don't have competition for strategic buyers. And that's very important to be successful in these deals, because if there are strategic buyers who want to do the deal, they'll win. Okay, so there were no strategic buyers. And then often we're competing with private equity like ourselves. But at that time, it had not occurred to anybody to go try to buy a bank in Japan. Just never, nobody thought of it.
You have lived through a number of economic cycles, including a big one, the great financial crisis of 2008. You were a major investor in financial services during that crisis. As we get further and further away from that event, has your understanding of it evolved?
A lesson from 2008, which is a timeless lesson, is, you know, where is the next overheated, overinflated, overleveraged thing happening? On the other hand, I also think that 2008, you had a financial system and financial institutions that were too leveraged, you know, not enough liquidity, and there were regulatory reforms after that, which have led to a much more liquid, stronger financial system. So that was kind of more unique to that crisis and has led to, you know, significant change for the better. So let's put it this way. This time, when this efflorescence, you know, has a downturn, which, you know, they always do and ultimately will, I don't think it's going to take down a bunch of banks with it this time. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think the banks will be fine. And the damage will be in other parts of investing in the economy more than with banks.
As a student of the Japanese financial troubles starting in the 1990s, do you see parallels to what's going on in China? Do you predict trouble coming out of the Chinese financial system?
So one thing that I think is not different is there were plenty of bad loans related to real estate in Japan, as there have been a lot of places in the world. You know, it's not, you know, America's done that plenty of times. And I have no doubt there's a lot of that in China right now in the financial system. But I think the biggest challenge for China and China's economy is, you know, is the system. You know, you have a sort of arbitrary, non-transparent, dangerous place. You know, you're doing fine today and you wake up tomorrow and you're not fine. And there are a lot of examples of that in a way that's dramatic and really seems very troublesome. So I think that's the biggest problem there. You know, I mean, if you viewed everything else is the same, would you rather have a dollar in the US or RMB in you know, a dollar in China? You'd rather have it in the US. It's a lot safer.
Do you have any predictions for where the next bubble or trouble might be coming from within financial services?
Here's one thing we don't have a shortage of: SPACs. We have enough SPACs, maybe we don't need more SPACs, but SPACs are a metaphor for what's going on in the market. Why do we have 40 SPACs trying to buy financial services companies? You know, that seems like a lot of SPACs. And if you look at the equity markets in general, let me put it this way, in the stuff that we know about financial services, we look at where some things trade and they are, you know, truly preposterous. And you've got sometimes preposterous prices for good companies. And then a lot of times you get preposterous prices for pathetic companies. So you can really see excess in equity market valuation. So I could see those coming down a lot. Leveraged loan market is another place. Now, leveraged loan market, you know, that isn't, you know, that's going to affect banks some and financial institutions some, but a lot of that is not in, that's not where it is. You know, that's, PE type or hedge fund hands. So I don't think that'll be so bad for the financial institutions. What brings the party to an end? I don't know. Rising interest rates might be one thing if that happened. That might bring the party to an end. Prices seem highly elevated but I don't think the risk is particularly concentrated in financial institutions at the moment.
On a positive note, you know, as a financial services investor, as you survey the opportunity going forward, what makes you excited? What makes you think like, you know, this is a great time to have capital to deploy into financial services?
We've done insurance brokerage deals recently in the United States. That was a perennial for lots of different investors, been a great area, continues to be a great area. In insurance, property and casualty insurance underwriting, meaning like hurricane insurance and earthquake insurance and that kind of thing, rates have been rising dramatically, and we've, you know, put some money behind that. You know, it goes through a long cycle, and it's own cycle in many ways, and that's in a good part of its cycle right now. So we're finding good things to do. We have a lot of activity out there. We're finding things that we find interesting, but as always, the trick is to pick the right ones. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's expensive. There's a lot of stuff that's not that good, and that's what they're paying us for, is to figure out the right ones to do at the right price, by the way.
Final question for you, very, very serious topic. I'd like to note for our listeners that you are wearing a tie. And when one thinks of men in business likely to wear a suit and tie, I think bankers would probably be at the top of the list. What is your prediction for the future of the tie in an industry that is seemingly shedding ties at a rapid rate?
Well, you know, I feel sorry for my ties, and that's why I wear them. And if you were to look at our, by the way, David, you look terrific, and you don't have a tie, and I can see that. I look around this office out here, nobody has a tie but me. It's partly because I feel sorry for my ties, and it's partly, you know, all these guys in like black t-shirts and all that, and I want to be different, so I'm wearing a tie. You know, I feel like it's marketing, it's making a statement.
So you're the rebel.
Exactly. I'm the rebel. Exactly. That's it.
That's great. Well, Chris Flowers from JC Flowers, thanks so much for speaking with us today. And I hope we can have you back on a PrivCap podcast at some point in the future.
David, nice talking to you. And thank you to PrivCap.
Like what you hear on the PrivCap podcast? Visit PrivCap.com for more thought leadership interviews, articles, reports, webinars, and more.